The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KUCI, its management, the UC Board of Regents, or history teachers. Good ones. Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shamba, welcoming you to the March 30th, 2021 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, my guest is Reverend and Chaplain William Somerville. For the full hour, he'll talk about his very intersectional work as he ministers to patients and their loved ones during the COVID pandemic. Let's start the show now. My guest for the full hour is Reverend William Somerville, an ordained Baptist minister serving as a senior pastor of Kingdom Come Community Church in Southern California and as hospice trauma chaplain throughout the LA and Orange County region, and will talk to us today in that particular capacity during the COVID pandemic. Reverend Somerville is also an advocate, an activist, previously a California 48th Congressional District delegate supporting Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential bid, and as an earlier elected delegate of the 73rd Assembly District of California in the Democratic Party. Reverend Somerville's current political goals include increased voter education, accessibility, and turnout. He's completed his Bachelor of Arts in Theater with a minor in dance from Henderson State University, Arkadelphia, Arkansas, and his Master of Divinity from Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary, Evanston, Illinois. He's currently a doctoral student at Omega Graduate School, Dayton, Tennessee, studying the integration of religion and society while finishing a Master of Arts in New Testament at Claremont School of Theology. His research interest involves a comparative study of measuring different racial groups' levels of cultural metriopathy. The goal of this research is to evaluate an elevated understanding of empathy for a more just and equitable society. Reverend Somerville comes to us today from his office at Hoag Hospital. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Reverend William Somerville.
Thank you, Claudia, for that introduction. Thank you for having me. It is truly exciting to be here. And as I was listening to you share of what you were mentioning of me in these introductions, I'm like, it sounds like somebody's not fully telling the truth, but I'll buy into this story any day, so.
Well, I first want to ask, it's rather a large lift, but I want to start us off on your background toward becoming a chaplain, some very intersectional work. Would you, Reverend Somerville, talk about all those roles coming together or tracking in parallel universes?
Okay, so I'm going to focus on how, in essence, we got here, because I think that's what the heart of what you're asking. Is that correct? Is that accurate to say, you think?
All things that come together as being a chaplain, because your intersectional work may be what defines this deep, deep role of what a chaplain contributes to a congregation and a broader community.
Yeah. So to begin, when I first acknowledged a divine call, a sense of call, a call to professional ministry in the context out of which I grew up, all I knew and understood, and you mentioned me being an ordained Baptist minister, in the Baptist church, all we say is we've been called to preach. That's it. And I was 19 at the time at Henderson State University, really pursuing a professional athletic acting career, as you further mentioned. And like I said, there was just this burning desire to be called to preach out of the Baptist tradition. That's solely what we understand. But wanting to pursue this professional ministry career with some integrity and preach, obviously, with some level of integrity, I made the decision to immediately finish undergrad and go to graduate school, which is where I got my Master of Divinity degree at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary on the campus of Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. And it was there at Garrett that turned out to be a lot more formative than what I thought in my maturing and matriculation in this thing called professional ministry. It was there where I learned about that ministry or doing professional ministry was not solely limited to the confines of a church building and not limited to preaching. And so I learned about military chaplaincy, and I did 8 years as an Air Force Reserve chaplaincy. And I was always told growing up as a young Black man, you have no place in the military. You shouldn't be in the military, but found out that there was significant reward and much reward in serving our country in this capacity. But not only was I not only introduced to military chaplaincy, but then I saw some of my colleagues do this thing called CPE. And basically they were going to the local hospital there and getting the training that they needed to become chaplains in a clinical setting, or more specifically hospital setting. And even would go with a classmate of mine who was a third year divinity student as I was a first year divinity student, and wake up with him in the middle of the night, and he would get dressed and I would ride with him to the hospital so he could attend to a patient that was in need because he was on call regarding trauma. And so I'm introduced to that area of ministry. Then I'm introduced where I was fortunate enough, I was a student pastor at the Liberty Baptist Church in Chicago, Illinois, which was one of two churches that received the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. when he sought to bring the civil rights struggle up north. And they were basically telling him, you need to take your movement back to the South. We don't have your race problems up here in the North, and we don't want anything to do with you at all, matter of fact. And the reason why that was significant is because the main person who was saying that to Reverend Dr. King at the time was the president of the National Baptist Convention, which was also the denomination I currently belong to. And eventually—
And who was that, may I ask, who is that person?
Thank you, thank you. Reverend Dr. John H. Jackson.
Okay. Okay. Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Great preacher extraordinaire, but had a very righteous, indignant, righteous hate towards Dr. King.
And really?
So, yes, 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 yes. And so they kicked him out because they considered him to be too radical. And I learned all this while I'm in seminary, while I was a part of a ministers in training program. The Trinity Church is infamously known, which was the church that Barack Obama attended when he was in Chicago, with that pastor being the Reverend Dr. Jeremiah A. Wright Jr. But yes, also people don't realize or know that that was also Oprah's church at one time as well too. So that was a very profound experience for me. All of that to say, I learned that there were many, many, many ways to express one's professional ministry and career. And so there were many directions to go. I then graduated from seminary, got married, and I stayed a year. My first job I received coming out of seminary was at First Presbyterian Church of Arlington Heights, where I served as the interim youth pastor or director of family and youth and ministries at that time. And then with being there for a year, staying in Chicago for a year, then we moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was there where I started another job at a youth services agency where it was to my demise. And unfortunately, I had gotten fired in my first 3 months there. And that was obviously a low point because I had never experienced being fired before, let alone people around me always worked and was never getting fired for misconstrued, misconceived, misunderstandings. So then after I lose my job, I'm like, okay, what am I going to do for money? I was then tapped by the Air Force Reserve to go and do backfill service as an Air Force Reserve chaplain at Great Falls, Montana, Malmstrom Air Force Base. It was there at Malmstrom Air Force Base, I clearly fully immersed myself into doing very in-depth ministry. Also found myself fully unaware of myself and how that was affecting me with the stress involved, be it experiencing a young man who experienced being drowned, unfortunately, and then taking up on soldiers that were coming back home from Afghanistan and Iraq through that war experience, during that time. And just, it just mounted up where I had gotten myself into some trouble and then not knowing basically how to get out of it. But what got me out of it then was my wife at that time moved to California because she was fortunate enough to get a job at one of the universities here in the Southern California region. Now with that said, and with all that I had gone through, and now that I'm out here in California following my then spouse out here, I'm looking for work again and trying to see what local churches are happening or see if they'll take me on as an associate pastor. Did that, but not really enough. So it dawned on my mind to say, okay, well, let me explore clinical chaplaincy. And so I went to St. Joseph Hospital of Orange, California. When I first moved out here, I first lived in Long Beach. So went to the hospital, and it was at the hospital I met the clinical pastoral education supervisor of a man by the name of Reverend Oliver T. Lee, who is one of my greatest mentors even today. But he didn't know me, obviously. I didn't know him, but I come there with my military resume, my Baptist, my pastoral resume, and my fancy seminary degree, and dressed to the nines and ready to make some money, now doing clinical chaplain ministry.
Wow.
And so, but I had to do what we call clinical chaplaincy training, which is referred to as clinical pastoral education training, where we basically learn about how to provide ministry in a clinical setting.
Now, like a whole raft of additional kinds of protocols.
Yeah, it's a whole new world in the words of Aladdin and Princess Jasmine. So when I get there, like I said, I'm ready to work, ready to make some money to be accepted into this program, which it did not offer any money. And I wasn't to be hired as a chaplain, but Reverend Oliver T. Lee, he told me this. He said, I don't know you. He said, I see you have an impressive resume, but I don't even think you would be available or ready for this program. And so what I need for you to do is go home and write me a 10-page paper of all of your failures, because clearly you presented to me all of what you've done, what you think to be good. And I'm like, well, shoot. After going through all that I've been through that got me to this point and so forth, and the failings of what has already transpired, it was no problem for me to write down all of them. And so we did that. And I was clearly at a low point. It's very, very low point at that time, because like I said, nothing was working out for me according to what I thought. And Reverend Oliver Lee, Reverend Lee, he called me back. He said my full name, which I further highlighted, William Moses Somerville, around what is basically sustaining me, my family lineage, history, culture, and faith. And he just said, you're totally ready for this. And
that's a wonderful approach, though, to finding out, to explore the applicant's history of failures to really. That says so much more than the flip side. So exactly. I don't know why am I learning this? I don't know if listeners have ever been through a comparable process, but the logic to this is, it's such an elegant way to be acquainted with the trials a person has survived and handled.
That's exactly it. I cannot elevate, highlight, and echo what you just said. Because it was there where I first better learned myself. And in learning myself, now I can better serve other people. I often share, so in essence, this is how I came to be a chaplain, okay? To answer the initial question, in essence, how we got here.
I just want to let listeners know, my guest, if you just tuned in, my guest is Reverend William Somerville, an ordained Baptist minister, serving as the senior pastor of Kingdom Come Community Church in Southern California, and is hospice trauma chaplain throughout the LA and Orange County region. And he's talking about the path to where he's come now in serving in Long Beach and Orange County, among other places. He's talking about the road, the path to his current chaplain service. So
what I often, and basically what I have shared with you is a slight introduction of how I introduce myself to patients and families.
Yes.
Be it when they come on, be it to hospice services, or when I'm meeting them for the first time in the hospital or at a facility, or just as much as, and this is going to sound crazy to you, even just as much as when I casually meet someone at that time when I was driving for Lyft, right?
So
I often share about the requirements that allow me to serve as a chaplain, which obviously those requirements consist of having, one, feeling called to this ministry, two, being an ordained minister, three, having a Master of Divinity degree, and at least 2 units of clinical pastoral education, or what we would call chaplain residency, equivalent to medical residency if you were a physician, okay? Those are requirements that I would that I had to fulfill. And I highlight the word again, requirements that I had to fulfill. But now when we talk about the qualifications involve that I am the youngest of three, dating back to being raised, born and raised in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, going to college in Arkansas, back to Illinois for grad school, got married, stayed in Chicago a year after grad school, lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, lost a job, now into Montana, Great Falls, Montana. I'm serving there, and I conceive a child, and then move out to California. California, while living out here in California, I've lived in Long Beach, homeless, Long Beach, Corona, La Habra, Vista, Aliso Viejo, now back to Long Beach. And going through all of those changes, going through all those life circumstances, loss of loved ones, loss of self-worth, loss of experiencing hard times, that's what qualifies me to be a chaplain, because in those days that I was going through those hard times, I was able to best relate to patients who wake up the next day to say, I'm still here, so I guess I gotta live. And so that's what qualifies me to serve as a chaplain, due to more of the uncertainty in life. And when we engage uncertainty, that's basically faith. Contrary to popular belief, faith does not address what we know. Faith addresses what we don't know. Because if we knew everything, then we wouldn't need faith or our spiritual expression.
Well, I'd like to talk about your role as a chaplain during this pandemic. And I'm just trying to, in my mind, to think about the plagues that are ongoing leading into this pandemic, the plague of racism, the plague of xenophobia, the plague of AIDS, HIV/AIDS. And I'm wondering if those were the kinds of plagues that sort of informed you about, okay, now I have a pandemic to deal with, and a lot of people are gonna be staying in place now, and people aren't gonna get together. So were those, any of those that I'm labeling as a plague, were they something that you tapped into, embraced, handle this pandemic situation?
Yeah. So it's really a great question. So what I found interesting is, little did I know, even still where I'm somewhat tickled by it of sorts, and that is, I have been prepped in my work, in my line of work, in where life has brought me. I have been prepped for what we are currently experiencing right now in ways more than what I could not have imagined. Because majority of my life, especially after once leaving home for college, has always consisted of uncertainty. And So uncertainty is my normal. And so now, and I had to like catch myself. So now that we're in this pandemic and things are surfacing in ways that we already knew was evident, but a side of society wanted to ignore it, right? Now that everybody now in light of this pandemic is feeling uncertainty, I'm looking at everybody like, what's wrong with you all? Like, let's get it together. And then I had to like catch myself and say, oh, wait, their once normal is now my normal. And so that's really the approach we took that I'm taking as I obviously serve in this chaplain capacity. And even just both in and outside of the official chaplain capacity or minister capacity, whatever you want to call it, because I can't clock out. I am of the only profession that you really can't clock out. So even maybe I could check out, but it's clearly not helpful in ways that would be healthy in limiting one's expression. So that's my approach to this with all what's surfacing and coming out now. It's always been there. And fortunate enough, I was cultivated in such a way to say, okay, it's okay to love the world in spite of how society and the world is not fully lovable, right? Mm. And so that's my approach. That's how we do so. Now, in the challenge being, how does one, this is what I would say is a working definition of what we talk about spiritual care or spirituality, and that is, how can we transcend one's human condition to look beyond their reality? That's basically how I would explore and define what we understand this work to be that I'm in. And it's work. It's no one-way thing. And once again, looking at reality, but still, you know, moving forward in spirit and in truth as best as we can bear witness, right? So yeah.
So, and as I introduced your talk, looking and investigating the measuring the racial group levels of cultural metriopathy, and that sounds like that's in your chaplain work. It's an ongoing sort of method in ministering people.
It's an ongoing enterprise to your point. So when we talk about cultural metriopathy, it's not a familiar term. Let me put
that. No, it's not. Right. It's actually a very new term for me.
Right. It's a very new term. And arguably, and I would even further argue that this new term is being birthed out of my current research that in my doctoral work that I'm doing right now, where I'm fortunate enough to be mentored by the Reverend Dr. Don Oliver, who is the former director of pastoral care of Hogue Hospital, Newport Beach. And so he's guiding me through this uncharted territory in what we are understanding and how we're wanting to elevate this concept of cultural metriopathy, which our operational and working definition of that being empathy emphasized through self-restraint, sacrifice, and renegotiating a new normal. And so that's what is happening in the exchange and the enterprise as I'm engaging patients on a day-to-day basis, and now seeking in my obviously research to expand it to say, okay, what does this mean for cultural groups in order to exercise this kinds of understanding in order to attain reconciliation? And the reason why I'm pursuing that in this is because what my research that I have thus discovered, and in light of what this pandemic, this plague has exposed and surfaced of what I would say we already knew, diversity, multiculturalism, cultural competency, and cultural empathy all fall short and have not fulfilled the goals of reconciliation, and especially racial reconciliation, as we had once thought, or what we had assumed, should I even say that? And so that's where the push is, that's where the drive is, that's where the passion involves, and we see where the chips fall. So yeah.
Well, I'm also looking at, there's the Hogue community, the greater Hogue community, and you've done all of this kind of political work in the 48th Congressional District and the Assembly District nearby. And so I'm wondering, how is it working that you are maybe steps ahead of a sort of a Caucasian dominant culture that when there is a chaplain showing up, it's not, they weren't expecting Reverend Somerville, but how, so what's that dance going? How's that going? What's that like? Maybe you've got a story or two ready to go.
Well, I mean, it's one, it's obviously exciting. Where I come from, so it's not really a dance for me. And if it be even a dance for me, I would say I came into this world dancing then.
Okay.
Right?
Because dancing wax is on the floor. You slide right in there and right. Are you ready?
Let me further clarify to say, as I earlier mentioned, I was born and raised in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, right?
Yes.
Which houses the main University of Illinois campus, Urbana-Champaign, right?
Right.
And the University of Illinois holds the largest number of international students per capita, according to the latest Guinness Book of World Records that I've last seen, which it could have changed. Let me be very clear about that. But it's a strong international community. But you obviously also have a dominant white European American community that you have to navigate as well. Diversity and being in diverse spaces was never an issue for me, even though it was a surprise for others. And that's the same response that I may get from patients, families I support and serve in this area. And once those barriers are broken down, then we get to the humanity reality of what one's experience is. Oftentimes I'm not rejected, if that would be an assumption. For your listeners out there, if you had not picked it up, if you had not known, I'm a Black African-American young man, descendant of chattel slavery, okay? So just FYI. But to that same end, how life has cultivated me in the context that I am currently in, culturally, has informed how I serve predominantly white European American community, as is the case here in South Orange County. Because of this, I'm often encountering people of different cultural expressions, racial expressions, socioeconomic expressions that are often very different than mine, but in a crippled capacity or in a limited capacity, where there's the connection in light of the society that I was brought in. And so I can exercise my love ethic, as Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman talks about, in my service in that capacity. My passion, my focus is to simply serve with a sense of awareness of the reactions of what may come toward you or toward the patients and their families that I serve, and in the capacities out of which I have served. But it's been mostly a very rewarding one. And not to say that there has not been issues, but the issues are easier or more easily worked through in light of, as I shared before, this limited posture, crippled posture, where I'm engaging patients and families and people that I serve when they encounter me. And we just go from there. So, yeah.
Some places are still not fully opening up. You're still a solitary person attending to that spiritual zone with that person in the most needy situation.
No, 100%. So I was still engaging family members. and arguably, I got, this is going to sound really weird, as I shared before, as society and people have come into this abnormality of situation, solitude, quarantine, all that stuff, this place is closed, my world never really changed. And arguably it got busier for me. Okay.
Oh, sure.
And I was still engaging families, just not families at bedsides. And if it were families at bedside, it was because in my context with the hospitals and hospice agencies that I work with, mostly obviously Southern California, Orange County area, it was as if to say, thank you all for coming. You cannot come in, and that's a good thing. Because if we're asking for you to come in and see us, then we need to be concerned. And so that's how the paradigm shift has taken shape and place. Mm-hmm. We're slowly opening up. There are slow openings where allowances are made here or there. And so that's how we deal with it. With the COVID patients that have passed away, there has been the exercise of us almost treating it when caring for patients as similar to what we would care for families. And for your listeners, this may trigger you. So I just want to give you a heads up to brace yourself.
Okay.
But it may trigger you, not trigger. We care for families and patients as if there are like fetal demises. And what I mean by that is in the experience or case of if you had a fetal demise, one of the challenges, obviously, for mothers mostly, as well as fathers, but mothers, obviously, who did not have the anticipation or expectation of obviously losing a child through birth, the fetus's, the child's foot is imprinted on a, be it an arm, a piece of paper or a canvas of sorts for the family to take home, even though the child cannot come home. The same with COVID patients. We got to a point where we had gotten a canvas where we could get hands of imprints of loved ones, imprints of the patients to give to their family members and loved ones to say, okay, you could not see them as they transition because obviously they're still contagious or we didn't have enough protective gear or what have you. We want to at least leave you with this as a point of reference if it be comfort for you and whatnot. So you have that, then you have me arranging for the priest to do FaceTime blessings or sacraments. And then
a chaplain does not do the sacrament?
If the chaplain is not Catholic.
Okay.
Right.
Because but there is.
Right. So when we talk about, you're asking the right question. And this is obviously clarity because obviously, like I said, many people don't know these things. So the chaplain is the professional name of the role of the minister in a clinical setting. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So when you, so for example, you go to church or because I am an ordained Protestant minister, my official title is Reverend William Somerville, William Moses Somerville. But if you were to meet me at church, because of my position in the church, I'm referred to as Pastor William Moses Somerville. Same thing in the hospital, because my position in the hospital is to serve in a religious role, spiritual care role in a clinical context, I'm referred to as a chaplain. So yeah, so that's how that works out. So if you have a Catholic priest or a Catholic priest, well, yeah, Catholic priest, because there are other priests out of other faith traditions.
All right.
Who provide sacraments. You can have both a Catholic priest and the Catholic priest who serves as a chaplain in a clinical setting. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah. Right.
Because one of my great colleagues, Chaplain Sandoz Kolaki, she's Muslim and she's a chaplain, but she's not an imam. So that's the issue. You have the professional title, but not necessarily the professional role. That's to your point around chaplains don't do sacraments. Yeah, but it is the responsibility of the chaplain if that chaplain, out of their faith expression, cannot provide the sacrament according to their religious tradition or faith tradition, then it is our responsibility to seek out the support that that patient and or family needs to get the sacraments according to their faith expression to better live out in a more holistic capacity. So does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. And so those sort of, like you said, the paradigm shift of the pandemic, where people weren't in the same physical space, but how you're ministering to people in different locations, and you had to figure out how to make it real off of that screen. There must be some narrative about that brings that up for our appreciation, a story.
So there's many stories. So let me,
of course,
which one do I want to use? So we had a COVID patient where this was a situation where the family was allowed to be present. And this family was Catholic, but the priest could not come in. So I arranged to do a FaceTime sacrament with the family, but more specifically with the COVID patient, because we could not go in the room. And so we had the priest provide a sacrament of the sick to this patient over FaceTime while the family's listening in, participating in it with all the protective gear that they had and being present there. And afterwards, after that experience, the family all left out saying, we feel comfortable to let our mother go now. Mm. Right? So that's one. Then there was a time where we as chaplains could not go into the rooms because we were not equipped to provide the care. So be it a home health aide, be it a nursing assistant or a nurse's assistant, they geared up, took in a phone to be at the bedside with their patient and loved one, and held that phone while we do a three-way FaceTime and I'm offering prayer to the patient while their loved one is on a FaceTime phone call with our nurse's assistant, holding it to the patient's ear that's in bed, lying in bed. So yeah, it varies.
So that was when maybe the personal protective equipment was at a real premium in the early months last spring. Yeah. And so where you could not get in, you were not covered up. So
exactly.
I'm just trying to let that three-way FaceTime sink in, how utterly complex and how sobering, how I don't know if there's a helplessness anybody in those three parties felt to make it come together, because there's no do-overs. This is going to be that person's final. That's passage.
And to your point, let me also say too, as a chaplain, I feel helpless. Okay. We, contrary to popular belief, we're not called to have the answers. We're called to be present. Mm-hmm. That's what's needed. Right. And what makes it seemingly, and this was just the feedback I got, is what answers the questions is to acknowledge the questions, to basically say, as you mentioned, there must be some helplessness there. This feels helpless. And so just verbalizing that as a spiritual care provider, say, you know what? I feel very helpless right now. Mm-hmm. And that's okay, because at least we're helpless together and we can journey through this and be present with each other. That's sufficient enough for that context. There may be more, and more will be provided if the situation and circumstance presents itself. And that's just more at the bedside, the patient critical care, with the anticipation of death happening.
Right.
Once I finish up with that, I then may hear a bell over the intercom of the healthcare facility, and I'm going to the emergency room to tend to now a COVID patient that was just brought in because they're not breathing well and they're calling. And now having to handle the family that can't go in at the bedside, right? In light of this trauma, and tending to the family to look at the patient from a distance being worked on, that they can't even kiss them, hold their hand or anything. And so I had asked them, do you have an item or a clothing or something that we can give to them that they can hold on to and take you in with them?
Oh, a personal effect that is the patient's, or that the patient had given and they have it in their possession to give.
Yep, Yeah, it just like.
And does that, you can see that sort of resonate, that the patient once receiving that, there's like, I don't want to say the vital signs change, but I do want to say the vital signs might change.
Right. Be it the vital signs change or not. But more specifically, when we look at this thing, when we're engaging in this work, it's all contextual. And that's why what's important in this work is having a high sense of awareness and having a very real skill set around listening and observing. Because while everybody else within your interdisciplinary team, among the healthcare professionals, they're reacting. They have to react. Okay, if they're not reacting, they're not doing their job.
Right.
But from my posture, from my standpoint, I'm serving, or the chaplain is serving, in an intervening intervention capacity. So it's all contextual, and how, and this is goes back to some of the theater and dance that you're asking. Be creative. Be creative. And I would encourage anybody, whenever you're experiencing hard times, or you're up against uncertainty, or things are not going your way per se, quote unquote, get creative and see where your creativity leads you, because there's value to intuition.
Well, to that point, it's actually one of the most generous, gracious bits of advice I had when I was losing my parents. And it was a very seasoned, well-acquainted family friend who just, her adage, and she said it several times, she said, "There are no rules, Claudia." So
exactly.
I guess that's where your creativity is then allowed. It opens up where you realize, oh, there are no rules. For those of you who've just joined us, my guest today for the full hour is Reverend William Moses Somerville, an ordained Baptist minister serving as the senior pastor of Kingdom Come Community Church in Southern California, and is hospice trauma chaplain throughout LA and Orange counties. And when we're talking about his bedside manner, actually, I want to know if any time during this year with family being remote, did that make it even more complicated for the chaplain when there wasn't unity among family members? Okay, does the chaplain deal with the family unity, or that's the physician and the nurse and others? Or does the chaplain have a role there too?
It would be the spiritual care provider, i.e. chaplain, role is still gaining its traction into becoming a part of the fully integrated, holistic healthcare system and process. Okay? Let me say that. We are highly underutilized. We are highly underpaid. I'm going to say that. We are not fully affirmed until people really see the value of our work. Okay? Let me put that out there. Now, with that said, when we're invited regarding family dynamics, family unity or disunity, right? In light of what decisions are being made and things of that nature, I have been privy and privileged to be a part of those moments of very heavy intensity that is taking shape in place, where it's coming to decision time, or decisions have not been made, and now we're being thrust into making decisions for loved ones and journeying with family members in what it means to make decisions. And so much so, there's one doctor who I think really grasped the value having a chaplain, and obviously me present. And this was really worked well when I was serving as trauma chaplain at Mission Hospital in Mission Viejo. And that is when the doctor gave me permission to basically give news to a family member about a diagnosis or even a patient passing away. They said, "Thank you for being there to take the emotional response for us."
Oh.
Because we can't handle that. Us doctors, physicians, we can't handle that. But you escorted us and walked us through how to care for the family, where we were able to get back to our job and attend to the patient. So how the dynamics work is really what's at best. Once again, what's the level of awareness? What does it mean to intervene when your role is being called upon as a spiritual care provider, i.e. chaplain? So yeah, dealing with families, it varies. Obviously, having a sense of awareness of what a family's cultural expression is, even more than just their religious expression, is informative about who to talk to, who not to talk to, who to give care to, who not to give care to, as well as what to expect in an emotional response in light of what their cultural expression is, which can be very culturally appropriate. So, yeah.
Well,
does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It does, actually. And it explains a larger role that we could consider bringing a chaplain into, and that what you're willing to take up in addressing, because I think some people might see it in a more limited role, and that your willingness to see an expanded kind of role in right. attending a family. It certainly, and that the clinicians, and I say that meaning medical, you're right, a clinician right, too. Right. I'm not separating from that, but that the clinicians are able to attend to their protocols and their specific duties at that. The lanes, the freeways lanes are all, they can all converge and separate, and that's but right. there's no obstruction in any that's of the right. lanes.
Yep, that's exactly it. And just to say as a caveat, and as you notice, I'm sharing about families. Obviously, I'm not mentioning any names. I'm not mentioning any numbers or anything like that. What's being shared and what's transpired, obviously, is confidential, obviously HIPAA appropriate. And we cannot divulge information unless given permission by the family, or as we do our, what I had earlier mentioned, our interdisciplinary work, we cannot bring up a situation or a scenario if it be of sensitive in nature, unless it's mentioned by one of our team members. Now, let me be very clear to say, if someone is a threat, then and wanting to be threatening to hold our confidentiality as a privilege, then clearly there are ethical boundaries that we cannot cross there all.
Oh, very, very, very clearly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So just wanted to put that out there too.
Of course.
To say that we are fully equipped and there to be supportive in a very confidential manner, in spite of what very blatant experience one could be experiencing, be it planned or unplanned. So yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I kind of like to pivot to a little bit of a kind of, it's a political realm. The national leadership factor, has that been consequential to how you do your job? How has your role filled in for, let's say, the absence of national voices supporting how patients are attended? That there for a while, there was no national memorial until there was really quite the sobering, very full, graphic, it's very tangible kind of memorial right at the eve of the Biden-Harris inauguration. So how does that earlier no leadership role, how did that play in what you wanted to do effectively for your charges?
So it's interesting, like, okay, so you touched on a couple of dynamics and that's a very loaded question and I totally welcome it.
Well, it is a loaded one, but I think it's like the elephant and the donkey in the middle of the room.
Right, right, right. So it's interesting you mentioned that, because you mentioned the national memorial that was held, right? I'm more, and patients more specifically, are focused on who are the national leaders than even the more memorial. Now, to answer your question as a real to answer part of your question, another part of your question, should I say, is for me to offer up and suggest the National Memorial is more for the loved ones and family members who had lost loved ones. As a chaplain, it's highly unlikely that I would hear that from patients, for sure, especially patients who have COVID. But also family members while being with their loved ones who are experiencing COVID. So that's one part of the answer. Another part of this answer is around, like I said, who the national leaders are. just my, like I said, awareness, 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 cultural awareness. My presence alone triggers off political responses from patients. In one of those ways being, you have some people who are very comforted by who their political leadership is and will share about it and what that means for them and transcend their context because that particular political leader is in office, or is our president or our vice president and what have you. And so one of the things, you know, that obviously part of our work involves as spiritual care providers is to be able to look at ourselves to say, what would we trigger off? What would we trigger off from the people that we encounter in the context that we're in? So yeah, and even if it not be as it be around race issues, right? Even if it not be around political, just the clothes that we wear. I don't dress up fully in a suit and tie, but I make sure that I'm obviously well-groomed, well-dressed because patients and families are seeing scrubs all the day, right?
Right, right. You're the civilian Superman.
Right. So it's like, whew, so I wear green, bright green colors, some yellow colors.
Really?
Yeah, just to mix it up sometimes. And that alone sets some things off. Sometimes I will wear a suit and what have you. So it just varies. But like I said, how our politics involve itself in response, from the response our patients and families get, it's all encompassing. Just as much as even in the care that we get, you know, from seeing, you know, and like, and most specifically, I talk about hospice, right? One of the things of hospice is that it's fully government funded. So in essence, it's Medicare for the dying. Okay. And many people are so amazed at what the government provides as a healthcare benefit when patients are receiving hospice care. And family caregivers are just like, where was this help all along? Like, and why does it have to be only when our loved ones are about to die? Right. So there's very robust conversations where people don't even want to come, robust conversations going on. So I mentioned the hospice side. Let me go back to the ER trauma side, where people are saying, I don't want to come in there because I don't have insurance, or I don't want to come in there because I don't want to have to deal with this bill. And I didn't drive in with, I didn't want to take the ambulance because it'll cost too much. So like I said, make no mistake, as much as there is a political response from patients and families just with what our national leaders are doing, but also who our national leaders are, but also what our national politics, our government is providing all the same. So, yeah.
So the last question I have while we're together, and it's very comprehensive, and I want to turn the attention to the listeners, what they bring to the setting for someone who's ailing from COVID. And I think you've already, in many senses, Reverend Somerville, answered this. And when you're talking about the interplay and the kind of creativity you're trying to have, but what do we need to understand is our capacity to be with those that are ailing from COVID?
Okay. So yeah, you're absolutely right. The creativity piece in how you know your friend, how you know your loved one, and how you know your neighbor, right? And redefining what it means to be a neighbor and a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that, but I'm gonna highlight the word ailing from your question.
Yes.
Because now I'm asking, what stage of ailing are we in? Because obviously if the symptoms are serious, and I guess I'm responding in a logistical manner more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
If the symptoms are serious, then the recommendation is call your doctor, tell them what symptoms you have, call your, not be it 911, or even just call the ambulance, being especially if you're surviving. Because as you may have heard, some of our EMT or ambulance personnel had to make very hard decisions of who to address, who not to address when it came for people dealing with COVID. So you have that. What does it mean to be present? Because of course, if you are dealing with COVID, then the question becomes, are you quarantining? How are you communicating with one another? Where do you stay? And how are we getting the word out to ensure others are protected? One of the challenges is, what's the testing tracking system that we have in place, or lack thereof? So yeah, it really varies. And it goes back to what you identified to say, how can we be creative? We're in essence called upon to be creative in how we engage friends, loved ones, and our neighbors, and be in community around that. So yeah, what's happening in the neighborhood? I know on social media within the Black community, I don't know if it's been so much in the white community, but or any other community at that, it may have been, but people have really been leaning on music and the arts. And when I say that, not just watching TV, but like you have what is called versus battles of groups battling it out in a fun way of sharing their songs, being that they were contemporaries in a particular genre. I think about when the DJ D-Nice decided to play music,
right,
and different songs and records, and it got everybody around the world dancing. I know if you saw some of what was happening over in Italy, from what I can remember, and I think, and clearly it was, some of it was happening in New York, people singing out of their balconies and people playing their trumpet or their trombone.
Or their cello.
Or their cello, yeah. And then you also saw virtual dating.
Right.
Where someone would make a table and so forth and have a social distance date. So, but focusing on, like I said, those ailing from COVID, then the question really becomes how to renegotiate, how to navigate being in community at a distance, basically. Passing love notes or just passing notes back and forth and things like that.
Well, I've definitely gotten some handwriting campaigns going. And then... Yeah. Then the advice columns followed my lead on that. But I do know a handful of people who never would have considered that. And once they've started their handwritten letter writing campaigns, this is like a whole new area. And I know it's going to carry as the COVID pandemic begins to peter out. They're going to keep doing that, though. Now, they got it.
Now, you mentioned COVID pandemic petering out. That's clearly the goal. That's what we hope. And I would further say, it's highly likely we're clearly in that forward movement. Let me put that out there. But one of the challenges is now, because we're not in surge mode as we once were as well. So, but when we were in surge mode, I even found myself experiencing, when I would walk onto, especially at critical care unit floor, experiencing some minor PTSD of mine, nothing overly, as a military chaplain, because the hospitals were looking like military hospitals. Let me put that out there, right?
Overwhelmment there.
Exactly, the overwhelm. Yeah. And so there's this bracing safe excitement happening among the medical professionals currently, because it's like things have subsided, but we also don't want to celebrate too soon because it's possible that a surge could happen again. It's interesting, and I guess because I was thinking about talking to you, because I was talking about you today. One of the things that I encountered with one of our ICU nurses is asking the question, obviously, of what they were experiencing with all the COVID patients that they had tended to, and at least 50% of those patients had passed away. I ask, how are you caring for yourself now that surge is over? And so, of course, family, friends, loved ones. So I said, my inkling, my intuition, my creativity, whatever you want to call it, I ask, how would you feel administering vaccination shots? And they said, that would be most comforting because we're so fatigued from not saving lives, we know we could, we would be active and proactive in saving lives.
Hear, hear.
Wow. Reverend Somerville, I have so many more questions, but our time is drawn down totally. I really appreciate your taking the time today. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I have thoroughly enjoyed myself. This has been fun. And we got to do it again. I would be happy if you invited me back.
Well, thank you. That you have a standing invitation. My guest was Reverend William Moses Somerville, an ordained Baptist minister, serving as the senior pastor of Kingdom Come Community Church in Southern California and as hospice trauma chaplain throughout LA and Orange counties. Talk with you next week. Thank you for listening, everyone. Masks and vaccines, they go together great.